It's episode 85.1 of We Talk Comics, WTC, back on the air and in the air. I am Mo, joined by Brett.
Hello.
Keith.
Mo, how's it going?
Good. And who's going to imitate Chris this week?
I forgot a beer, so I can't do it.
Just screw up,
guys,
a word.
I am also here on the show.
You sounded like you're somebody in Brooklyn. I don't know what the hell that was. Anyways, this is episode 85.1. Of course, last week we had mentioned that we were going to be doing some retro comic book gaming. And because last week's episode, we'll be honest with you, it had a few hitches. And when I say a few, I mean it had more hitches than a trailer park does generally. And we've taken these steps to fix that. But this show didn't turn out quite how we wanted. So we thought we'd go back to the basics, which is what this episode is called. And also, Chris wants to be there for the gaming episode. So this episode is just simple. We just picked some storylines or miniseries, trade paperbacks, or whatever that have come out from major publishers. Pretty much every major publisher has one, except for Image, which got two. And we're just going to talk about them. It's just going to be straight old-fashioned talking comics. And, of course, we'll still have our Wii views. But the other thing we got is Comicosity sponsoring the weekly news with Cup Reporter K, what's going on?
Well, it seems like there's a comic convention every week these days. Every big city has one. Some cities have two. This week there's one in San Diego.
There is one in San Diego. There's one in San Diego, I have to say, it's a perfect time to find out everything that's going on by visiting our sponsor, Comicosity. Hey, we just do a podcast. That's it. But that's where you can go and you can find out all the lowdown on what's happening. I got to tell you guys, if Comicosity's numbers are skewed for the amount of time the people have spent on their website, it's probably all me because I've spent so much time there this week because the site's so great, run by the two classiest men in comics, Aaron Long and Matt Centauri Griffith, and I've spent so much time on that site over the last few days when I should have been working that if my boss finds out, I'm going to have to pay them. But anyways, back to the news, Keith.
Well, they are our pals, Aaron and Bud Centauri Griffith. Before we started recording, I actually said I don't know what to do for the news because – with San Diego going on, there is so much news coming out that by the time we Brett edits out all the swears and curse words and
Duker isn't on this episode.
Yeah, we're totally safe.
Well, not once Brett finishes editing enough. there'll be so much more news. So I'll say right off the top, visit Comicosity's page. They have a page for what's happening at San Diego Comic-Con that they are constantly updating. Only the comic news coming out of Comic-Con. And I'll be visiting that a lot. There is already a mass of stuff that happened earlier in the week. It is preview night on Wednesday night, so there's already panels and announcements happening.
For example, we'll say the evening we're recording this. Go ahead.
For example, Dynamite has a ton of stuff happening. Dynamite has gotten ahead of the game with some crazy announcements of a lot of new TV and film projects. They've got a Bob's Burgers comic coming. They've got a Twilight Zone comic written by Joe Straczynski.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Joe Straczynski was the showrunner on the 1980s version of Twilight Zone.
Which is underrated.
It is. That first episode of the 80s version with Bruce Willis and the Harlan Ellison written story is probably what it's. It is a lost gem of Twilight Zone, for sure. We're also getting Howard Chaykin returning to The Shadow with a miniseries called Midnight in Moscow.
Will The Shadow be boning Miss Fury?
I don't know how much boning he did in the old...
Shaken. He's going to find a way.
The old version. Depends on... We may or may not. It's Dynamite. They're not known for the edgiest of edgy.
But they'll have eight covers commemorating it.
They will indeed. They'll have a Dave Sim and then six by Howard Chaykin. And then there'll be an Alec Ross.
No.
Does he just own a chunk of Dynamite? He must. He must have stock or something. We are also getting from Dynamite, it hasn't been called it yet, but what looks like Heroes Season 5.
Yeah, I saw
Colin that. Colin Bunn will be resurrecting NBC's Heroes with a new comic series set in continuity.
Yeah, I heard that too. What's the matter with Jeff Loeb? No time?
Loeb, probably no time. Loeb's a busy guy.
I don't know why.
He's been doing TV stuff, not comic stuff. And we're also from Dark Horse getting a licensed product, Joe Straczynski and Pete Wood, Terminator The Final Battle, which is a new Terminator series that is to collect up all of the best parts of the film continuity and perhaps even the TV continuity.
I'm Terminated out for quite a while now, so.
And there's lots more coming from San Diego all the time. We do expect that Marvel and DC's big announcements will happen on the weekend. So we'll get into those next week in a bit of summary. For now, that's the news.
Good stuff. All right, Keith. There's something you didn't get to that I'll get to. First off, some big news. I don't think you saw this, or did you mention this? Brett mentioned this to me earlier. This is actually, I think, not only news, it's also because it's happening. It's also news because it's tremendously disgusting to me. And Todd, the last kid on Earth, is going to become a cartoon. Or the ugliest kid on Earth, sorry. Todd, the ugliest kid on Earth. If he was the last kid on Earth, I still wouldn't read him. Is going to become a cartoon. Maybe the worst comic book I've picked up in years. Offensive on every level. And the fact that they're going to be somebody's going to turn that into a property, I just find that repugnant.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel.
You know that that's going to be a movie before Team Hawkman is disgusting.
That's going to do anything before anything is.
Well, it is. No, honestly, I don't understand it. It's so bad. And the thing is, it's incredibly offensive on so many levels. It's offensive. That book's offensive both by the content and by the quality. So why this is happening, I can't understand. But it is. So, I mean, hey, I guess I must be missing something. That said, the other big news I have is, and this is Keith, you might have seen this too. Michael Keaton will not be returning as Batman. This is just breaking news.
Breaking
news. I wanted to
San Diego Comic Con 1992.
That's right. I wanted to let Bud Santori Griffith know that Michael, I know it's a big deal for him. Michael Keaton not returning as Batman. Folks, you heard it here. Not first.
Probably even last.
But you did hear it here.
It may have been broken up by others.
Neither is Christian Bale. Anyways, off of that, you always want to hit this week's subject?
All right.
Well, it's like I said, what we're going to do is we're going to go through. We have books from every publisher. This isn't going to be Wii Views. We'll still be doing Wii Views. The Wii Views is where each of us does kind of a sound bite and sums up our opinion on this. This is going to be more like discussions about these books that we're going to have between us. So the books that we have, and in no particular order, and we will absolutely, we might jump around talking about them. Daredevil End of Days from Marvel. Five Weapons is from Image. We have another book from Image, Snapshot. Edison Rex is from Monkey Brain. We have Strain, Volume 1 and Volume 2 trade paperbacks that we've been kind enough to get sent to us as previews, and those are from Dark Horse. Polarity is from Boom. Planet Death is the Exo-Manomorph major storyline that wrapped up. We have DC with the Jeff Lemire's first story arc with Green Arrow. Masks from Dynamite. Highways from IDW. Did I forget anything, gentlemen?
I think that's a lot.
Seems like it.
It was a lot.
Seems like a lot of damn comics.
It was an awful lot of reading. I think we're fortunate, though, because, I know what's my least favorite of all of them. I have difficulty on what my favorite is. Actually, I don't know what my least favorite is. There's a couple that are on the lower end, but on the lower end of this group is still a good book. Like, I think we're fortunate in the ones that we picked. We tried to pick things that were just kind of that looked interesting, that we maybe weren't reading. Maybe some of it we were reading, some of it we weren't. And that kind of gave us a chance to get an idea of what every publisher is kind of putting out there, the different personalities. So, guys, you know, Brett, Keith, which one of you wants to talk about some comics?
Well, I think it was interesting as we were trying to put together a sampling list, because we were trying to go with not necessarily things that we all would have read. Some of them we might have read on our own. And it was hard finding a DC. I mean, DC they haven't found their footing on miniseries right now. And we started with, you know, we talked about arcs, but we wanted to start with miniseries so that we could have a nice complete read. And in some cases, like Edison Rex is an ongoing Monkey Run and sort of has miniseries, but a lot of the miniseries haven't wrapped up yet for that they've started. Monkey Brain's kind of a nice compact 6 issues. But DC, we looked at the last couple. There's none coming out right now. There's a couple that are tied into the event. So we went with an arc instead. From the big two though, Daredevil End of Days, this was like old school miniseries for me. This was a big deal. This was a self-contained story. I cannot wait to put this as a trade right next to the Miller Daredevils. Just thematically, it fits so well with them. This was to me what a miniseries should be and used to be for the big two.
How successful was that on the sales? I'm not sure if either one of you would be aware. How successful was Daredevil End of Days?
Miniseries are a pretty hard road right now. Mm-hmm.
Anything could sell, it would be this, though.
Yeah, I mean, what tends to happen with miniseries, I'm just pulling numbers up as I'm blathering. What tends to happen with miniseries from especially the big two, but really in everything, is the first issue will do quite well as people sample it and as stores sample. And then people do one of two things. They either stick with it, and we see those numbers drop pretty significantly for the store orders, or knowing that it's going to be a compact story, and from any of the big two or Image, it's going to be in trade later, you're just making a choice of, well, I'm going to pile it up and read it as a whole miniseries, or I can wait like 3 extra months and buy it in trade. I might as well just leave it. Mm-hmm. So the first issue is the sample, and then you'll see you again when the trade comes out.
That's one thing that we were looking at DC. They do have an inordinate amount of trades, you know, to come out. But like you say, not miniseries. Boom also, other than Polarity, they haven't had miniseries in months unless you account the continuing miniseries that are, you know, Adventure Time, and I really don't. Even Polarity, I'm sure, will be continuing in some form, whether it's a regular or another miniseries. But this is the only one they had in months as well that would have qualified.
End of Days, actually, as I pull up the numbers, did really, really well for a miniseries.
Mm-hmm. For a miniseries or just really, really well?
I would say really, really well for a miniseries. Reasonably well for a mid-level character. To give you, I'm on the Comic Chronicles, which is the site we always use for numbers. Daredevil End of Days number 8, 26,000 copies, which puts it around where Avenging Spider-Man sells, around where Green Arrow is selling, and about 9,000, just ballpark 10,000 copies less than the ongoing by Mark Waid.
Okay.
Daredevil.
So that's pretty, is that enough that DC could go, hey, maybe if we put the right talent on the right character, this will be successful? I mean, Marvel has not given up on Brett, that was another one that actually wasn't announced by you today, but David Morrell, of course, most famous for, I think, creating and writing First Blood and Rambo, creating the Rambo character, as well as Extreme Measures, another film got turned into a Michael Keaton project back in the 90s, is going to write a Peter Parker miniseries, as is Matt Kent. So, I mean, they certainly haven't given up on it.
No, I think that, I think what they're doing with Spider-Man is fantastic. And it's chronicled actually in the new, Chasing Amazing blog. So you can go check that out. But I think that with Marvel.
It's a damn good blog, by the way.
It is a very good blog. But I think that, when I look at Marvel, They are putting...
They also, by the way, they also have a nice little podcast, too, for Spider-Man fans. Just throw it out there.
But I think that when you look at Marvel, they are actually putting talent. I mean, end of days. I mean, that's Bendis, that's Jansen. I mean, that's good talent on that.
Even David Mack, right?
And David Mack, absolutely. Like, this is very good talent for a miniseries, you know, and even the new one. I mean, the opening story with Lee Weeks and stuff like that. I mean, and then you talk about Morrell and Matt Kent and stuff like that. This is great talent. I mean, if DC started pulling out some great talent and put them onto miniseries as well, then I think they would probably get some pretty decent sales.
Oh, I mean, the last thing they did was what, Palmiotti and Gray on The Ray? I mean,
yeah,
they were trying to set something up.
Yeah, but does anybody expect that to sell when you hear that? When you hear The Ray, a new version of The Ray by Palmiotti and Gray, does anybody expect that to sell? I mean, their Watchmen, they put talent on those. Those were successful, weren't they?
Yeah, very. I mean, they had the same drop that as I was saying about miniseries. There were a lot of people like myself, actually, who tried all the first ones, said, I really enjoy these. I will get the hardcovers when they come out. So instead of buying them twice, I just left them all.
But if they do, even if people do get them at hardcovers, isn't that still going to be financially down the road and for years to come, financially viable?
And those before Watchmen hardcovers are the best sellers right now. They're top in the in the collections sales right now. They're top graphic novels on Amazon, etc. New York Times. They're doing extraordinarily well.
Someday a topic needs to be our favorite miniseries from Marvel and DC. The kind of featured characters that are, you know, because I mean, I don't want to see them give up on this. I have always enjoyed the miniseries as a format.
Well, right now, I'm glancing at the June sales numbers here, and look, I'm just kind of scanning for the miniseries. We've got the Age of Ultron event, of course.
Which is more of an event than a miniseries, though.
Yeah, and DC's not doing those at this point. They're doing crossover events, but they're not doing a core book when they do them. Kick-Ass 3, which of course ties to the film property. And then the next one we have that I see here for minis.
Do you think Jim Carrey's reading Kick-Ass 3? Sorry.
He's reading it, but he's not talking about it. We go down, Kick-Ass 3 at number 10, and then the next one I see is number 27, Thanos Rising, which is doing incredibly well for a book that doesn't have big names on it. Very much on the excitement for Thanos after the Avengers movie. But then it's a long time before we see another miniseries in the,
Do we see, cause I mean, we did, pick two from Image basically because we could have picked, if we're looking at series that wrapped up in the last couple months, we could have picked 10. I mean, they have so many, you know, do you see any miniseries from Image at all in there?
There's not, and I mean, Image tends to sell quite a bit lower, and there's a lot of trade waiting on Image because they do flip so fast.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually only a couple of Image books in the top 100. 10 grand is doing quite well. I can't remember if that's an ongoing or a mini.
Walking Dead and SAG, obviously.
Yeah, Walking Dead, which is ongoing.
10 grand is as long as he feels like taking for the first story arc, then he's going to take a break and then he'll come back and do another story arc at some point. So,
yeah, I'm seeing mostly the ongoings.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
jumping out.
Consistency is so key with sales figures. I mean, if you can maintain a consistent publishing schedule, then your sales numbers are going to stay fairly consistent. But if you're up and down on your sales numbers, and I mean, miniseries are tougher just because, I mean, they can be 4 months and you don't get a chance to really develop the loyalty in that case.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, interesting. So any other thoughts on kind of the... what we're looking at there? You want to talk some more specifically kind of about the books, guys?
Well, I think that Masks, which I remember giving a really good review when we did the first issue.
I remember, though, issue, not knowing that Alex Ross was going to only do the first issue.
Yeah.
That made a difference. Yeah. Sure made a difference.
Yeah, it did.
I believe weighted heavily when we reviewed it. And I in general, really enjoy Chris Roberson. but, and I've always heard that if the word but is in the sentence, it doesn't matter what you said for the first half of the sentence. But masks is exactly what I don't like about Dynamite as a general rule. Reading the entirety of Masks, I felt like I was missing something because I don't know 70 years worth of pulp characters. Particularly when it got to the big reveal in issue 7 of who was behind this whole thing. And I went, was I supposed to know that guy?
They mentioned him, I think, in issue 3.
They did mention him earlier,
a two-panel thing, kind of another character. Mentioned him and talked about him and how important he was to him. So there was that, but it's easy to miss. I think you're right. I mean, there's definitely characters, like, I'm not familiar with Black Terror, you know? I mean, he's walking around. It's about, you know, he's walking around in, I mean, this is an 8-issue miniseries, and he shows up, I think, in issue 3 or maybe issue 2. Not the first one, certainly. But he's walking around. I think it's late in issue 7 before I figure out, oh, he's got super strength. Like, that's, kind of something that kind of, like, does sum up the book for me. I still enjoyed it, and it did hurt without Alex Ross there. I mean, I don't have a single book in this group that I didn't enjoy, but if I was to put it on the lower end, it's one of the two books that I look at, one of the two story arcs that I think is on the lower end, just because it's nice to see these pulp characters, and generally it's nice to see characters that aren't too superpowers or whatever, but this feels like it's, you know, Dynamite's just constantly churning out these pulp characters in these unimportant miniseries and series after series where they're just kind of there and there's nothing, no gravity to anything that's happening, you know?
Well, I think for me, my problem was the fact that it felt like the actual miniseries itself was 4 issues worth of story. But what they had to do was they had to tell 62 characters worth of just jammed in there. So they extended the 4 issues out to 8. And so it was kind of like half of the middle was kind of like, oh, I didn't really need that because it was just kept constantly like, oh yeah, so here we are with the spider and a couple of other guys. And meanwhile, way back over here, we've got, you know, the Shadow hanging out with Green Hornet and stuff. And it's like, I get it, but it's just not enough.
You know what? And you know what? It's amazing that, I mean, I think it probably would have been better served as a 6-issue miniseries, but it's amazing because you talk about this. It's like they have to go out to 8 issues so they can fill out all these extra characters. And yet I still don't feel like the switch from the character who's introduced, who later becomes Zorro, I still don't feel like the point where he decided to become Zorro was at all explored.
No.
You know, it's just he mentions that this is a legend for his people. Next thing you know, he or she's showing up and walking around like this. And where'd he get the costume? Where'd he make the actual decision? Like, you know, so many characters. They don't, in some ways, they all get a little bit of time, but not enough to actually explore them. It's just kind of, I don't know.
It could have actually been a regular series by itself. Just
yeah, really
the whole idea of going after the Justice Party, you could have easily told probably in the 3 years worth of stories just involving all these characters. Sure, I don't know how that would impact the rest of their line of pulp characters. You know, it's just like, well, why would I bother reading the Shadows regular series? I can catch him in Masks with everybody else.
It's true, yeah. You know, I did find the Shadow to be the coolest character. Maybe not the best character, but certainly the coolest.
He was cool. I mean, I did, for the characters that I know, which is not to say that's a lot, I found them, you know, interesting, and I liked their characterization for the most part.
Yeah, the characters you're familiar with, the Green Horton and Hornet, or not Hornet. The Green Horton. And he hears a who.
Yes.
Yeah, the Green Hornet and Kato and the Shadow and yeah, these characters I think they were well done.
I will say
for what it was.
I will say one thing about the art though, especially like, you know, Alex Ross art in the first one, of course, which set the bar impossibly high. But when you have Alex Ross still essentially doing, you know, like the art direction, which will basically amount to layouts in this case, and then but the art itself was so weak within those layouts, because, I mean, Alex Ross is so detailed. And then you go, like, issue two, where it's fairly competent, but then by the time issue three goes, it's getting a little worse, issue four, et cetera, et cetera. And by the end, I mean, you're not even getting backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You're actually, it's just like characters against nothing. I mean, it looks like a 1980s Image comic.
Only with less muscles. Wow. I think that it almost came across to me like they were trying to hide the fact that they're rushing this with nice inking. Nice coloring, let's hide the fact that we're actually not getting the level of detail that you necessarily would expect.
Yeah, ultimately, I just thought it was too bad. You know, like it's this amazing start. You know, issue one is just sets the bar so high, and it just can't live up to that at the end for me.
And that's Dennis Calero who did the art on it. And of course, as mentioned, Chris Roberson wrote it.
Yeah, I think that this is indicative of a lot of Dynamite stuff, though. I mean, they have these incredibly well-known characters that have been around for, you know, some of them closing on 100 years. we're like 80 years on a lot of these characters that they've been around in so many different forms. They have control of them, and yet it feels like they're doing licensed material. It feels like that these characters are so untouchable that nothing happens with them. There's no depth to them.
Yeah, they're not willing to take it that much further. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I think that's true.
And it really puts me off so much of what comes from Dynamite that, if I was already, I mean, it's like any kind of property book. I mean, Chris always complains about the property books. If I was already invested, it might be worth doing worth me reading a treading water storyline. But I'm not really invested in pulp characters. So it just doesn't feel like that anything happens in the books at all.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. Well, I still enjoyed it. I just wouldn't say I loved it personally.
It was
on the flip side. Go ahead.
It was on the lower half for me, but
it was like I say towards the lower end. But I still think it's a good. I think it's a good book. It's just not. It's not a great book. So
Keith, flip side.
So let's look at the opposite thing, though. I mean, we've gone from a book that's entirely about the property to a book that's entirely about the creator and the property doesn't matter. Highways by John Byrne from IDW. Byrne is working almost exclusively for IDW, has for a very long time. He gets a really great deal there. They gave him a great cover. They gave him a great rate for covers, so he does a lot of covers for them. All of his creator-owned work, he makes back-end points. So if it sells, he makes more money. If it doesn't, then it's on him. This is another creator-owned four-issue space story from John Byrne. What do you guys think about? I mean, this is kind of a good example of what IDW does right now.
You know what? It's a book that we gave a solid review to, and yet if we hadn't done this, I never would have read it. I mean, honestly, it's just off my radar.
Yeah, you just wouldn't have found it.
I really wouldn't have found it, partially because it is a space story, science fiction story, and partially also just because John Byrne was so great and then so not. He's had a resurgence, I have a feeling here, but again, it's easier to fall than it is to rise again. In the minds of people, once that image is there. And I think I've certainly been battling that with John Byrne, but I really, really enjoyed this.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really good, like, by the end. I think it took some, I'm kind of glad that I took some time off after the first issue, because I think it gave me a chance to, when I came back to it, I was just like, okay, well, I know I read the first issue, but I'm not going to start from issue two. I'm going to reread issue one and go through. And I think that helped, because when I first read issue one, it was like, okay, this is kind of weird with the characters. You know, it seemed just, yeah, John Byrne. But you know, then you read it again, you get the feeling for the characters again, and then by the time you reach the end of the story, you kind of see that it has a lot of the elements of classic John Byrne in it. And it is a very interesting story. The only downside that I would say is that it might be a little too, like, there's a couple of books in here that almost feature too many, you know, flips in the story. And I think that this could be that could be the only downside to this.
It certainly had a lot of twists and turns. No question about that. You know, I mean, but in a good way. It wasn't twists and turns where I couldn't follow the story. It's just twists and turns within the characters and the plot that completely made sense to me. I mean, if I had one complaint about this book, it's, and I love John Byrne's art, and I'm a fan of John Byrne's art, but at a certain point in time you go, Jesus, these people's faces, I've read in 1,000 John Byrne's books. It's like he's run out of faces. And other than that, like, that's my only complaint about the book, honestly. I like the twists and turns, and one of the things I really appreciated was there's a lot of little subtle things which makes me go, he really thought this through. A lot of things where they would say things simply like, okay, you know, you're walking along there. Okay, this is going to happen to you now because this would happen to you if you're in this situation in space. Like, oh, your gravity is going to shift and this is what will cause it and react. Like, he'd spent a lot of time figuring out these little details of the world and putting it into the dialogue and putting it in there. And it created a really organic universe for me. And I know he had, you know, I felt that. I felt these weren't things that created anything in the actual plot or story, but it just let me know that there was a logic behind everything and really well thought out. Really, other than the, you know, he needs a new face or two. Other than that, we're good.
I will say that one of the things that I learned from this book is that I've been too hard on Chris Claremont. Because on the early first couple of issues of this, there are so many points that the dialogue and text is disjointed from what's happening in the panel. And I always blamed that in X-Men on Claremont, but clearly Byrne has drawn the pages and then gone, actually what's happening here doesn't quite make sense. So I have to put in a piece of dialogue to explain what's happening between these two panels. But I think it was neat. I think it's, I mean, that shows though that he's not getting heavily edited. You know, so, you know, warts and all is what you're getting. It is, you know, people want these creators to have all the control. This is what happens when you get control. So sometimes it, you know, there's some rough edges to it and, but you may get a better story, because of those rough edges. I thought it was a cool book at work. I think it was interesting coming back to it now. I probably would have grabbed it at, you know, as a discounted trade paperback in 5 years. So it was, I'm glad I read it now instead of five years.
It's put it in my mind that John Byrne isn't done, which is something that has been in my mind for a while. In fact, there was a point where we had talked about potential subjects. I'm sure somebody, you know, John Byrne what was it? We managed to do Frank Miller in one show, but we were thinking John Byrne in anywhere from 2 to 75 parts.
somewhere in that range.
Somewhere in that range. And I'm sure at some point we still will. But, I mean, I suggested the title, The Rise and Fall of John Byrne. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's The Rise and Fall and Rise Again.
You know, I mean, there's no question this is not the John Byrne that we grew up with. But that's not to say that it's bad.
It's certainly not Spider-Man Year One awful either.
That's good.
I would much rather, and actually the Doomsday book he's doing right now is really good as well.
Is that Doomsday Point One? Is that the name of the
Doomsday
title?
Doomsday Point One, yeah.
Yeah, no, I saw that and I thought, now I'm going to read this. Now I'm going to try this. So, I mean, that's absolutely a win. But
yeah, I mean, it's kind of a cottage industry. I mean, he's picked his spot at IDW. He's got a good relationship with them. They don't mess around with him because he's been a guy that's long. You know, I laugh when people talk about editorial kerfuffles now because there must be 20 stories about Byrne walking off a book from either of the big two.
Yeah.
Over 30 years.
He's a pain in the ass. Nobody's going to deny that.
So many books that he just walked out on, because he didn't get along with editorial. So I mean, these aren't new issues at all, but I mean, this is what happens when you have enough of a following. You can just go off your corner. He doesn't really respect the internet. He's not on Twitter. He has his one website that he goes to his forearms on, and that is the only presence he has. He's found his niche, and that's where he'll be until they put him in the old Canadian song.
I'm cool with that.
There is an old Canadian song. Right? We don't tell you about that. It's right before on the ice slopes. You're sucking too much from our healthcare.
Well, absolutely. Everybody knows I'm not making the cool Canadian old age home anyway, so I'm not worried about it if I don't know about it. I didn't have a shot. Since this is in space, let's go into another story that's spacefaring. I want to get your perspective on Planet Death from Exo Manowar. And the big reason why is, of course, because Brett and I have read the entire series. So I think our perspective coming into it would be different than yours, because even though this is the Planet Death storyline, this is really... it's really a 14-issue storyline in many ways, in that everything has been built up and leading up in little points put in place for motion for this since the very beginning. So I'm not sure how it would have played differently to you as a – Brett would have read all of Exo in one run, whereas I've read it monthly since the beginning, and then we have you just reading this self-contained storyline, and I'm not sure how it turned out for you.
Well, I had read the first two, maybe three issues, and Exo didn't grab me the way that a couple of the other Valiant books have. But that said, I didn't really have any challenges getting back into the story. I read from, what issue did we start on? Issue 10, which is kind of the prelude, yeah. And not even the beginning of the prelude. I think it's like the second part of the two-part prelude. And I had no problem following the story, getting it set up everything well for me. I really enjoyed the story. And again, we want to talk about what we're trying to pick sample books to describe a publisher as well as, a specific book. I think that this is a good example of what Valiant's doing really, really well, is they have a shared universe. They have characters that are doing some levels of crossover. Some are really involved. Some are at lower levels. But most of the books are intended to stand fairly well alone, and I had no problem following the story and being interested in where it was going the whole time. So it's really tightly written. It's I learned a lot about this character over the story. We'll probably continue getting XO now, and also filling that gap of a half dozen or so that I didn't read. But I think it's a great example of what they're doing really, really well right now.
I think it is a really good example of kind of Valiant's marketing strategy and strategy from you were sitting there literally going, I can't wait for this book, like for the wrap up that really amped up like that for you, didn't it?
For me, yeah. Because when we did the Venditti interview, it was still one or two issues away.
I think one issue away at the time.
Yeah, and so absolutely to reach near the end of Planet Death, and then to know that it was just going to wrap up like the week after we talked to Venditti, it was absolutely on the top of my list. Even the next issue was, I read pretty quickly, but Planet Death, like the final issue of Planet Death, absolutely 100% sold me on the character and on the series.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of, I think it's Venditti's style. He's very much, and I think it's very much Valiant kind of has this found creators who are this way, that they set things up. They have patience in telling their stories, which you can't say every creative team out there necessarily have, but they found a creative team that have patience in telling their stories and enough trust in the audience to be able to follow them and read them and enjoy them. And also, really, really good. He returned to it, and now he was off it with the latest book. But, I mean, he was there for the first few issues, then he left to go to Toronto, and then, he's back again for a little bit. And I think he creates a visual energy that a story of this intensity needed. And, I think he was definitely key to it as well.
Well, I love his, like, when he inks his own stuff, I love it. Like, I thought that was the best.
So, okay, Exo Manowar is definitely a hit, too. I mean, that's good. I mean, different, I think, than what you're getting from mostly Marvel and DC, too. But still a superhero storyline, so I really like it. Okay, well, let's move on, Brett. Why don't you, what do you want to talk about? What are you kind of on your mind, that big, beautiful, red-headed mind of your, I don't know what the hell I'm saying.
All right.
What's on your mind?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that that I'm going to talk about polarity. This one I know you kind of brought to the table late because we had kind of forgotten Boom a little bit. And Polarity was one of those ones that I remember reading the first issue and thinking to, and I think we even said that, you know, if it goes one way, it could be a really good series. If it goes the other way, then it's not the kind of series that that we'd be all that interested in. Like if it goes a little too superhero.
Well, the thing is, it appears to be one book through all of issue number one until the last page, where it appears to be a whole other book. And you're like, okay, which is it going to be? But we got our answer.
Yeah, we definitely got our answer. I mean, for me, like, I actually found this one to be the biggest struggle to read. In fact, I actually almost gave up at issue three. But I thought, oh, there's only one more issue left. I'll power through it. I think that my biggest problem with it was the dialogue. I completely lost it with this guy who's talking about like hating this these hipsters and stuff like that. And yet when he's in there, he's constantly talking hipster to all these characters. He's talk like every bit of dialogue out of almost every character struck me as the way it would be written in an idealized movie version of it. It's not actually the way somebody would talk, but it's an idealized movie version of the way you would think that these people would talk.
And that was your issue? That can maintain for you through the whole thing, including the fourth issue then? Because I think that's kind of the thing about it, Brett, is that's supposed to be the irony of the character. And that's supposed to be, like, to me, this dialogue and the art style, too, it reminded me of Kyle Baker. Because you could say that about Kyle Baker, too. You could say that about Why I Hate Saturn, you know? And he recognizes this by the end. That's kind of the character arc, is that he recognizes himself for everything he is as well, and everything that's his own, you know, issues. So I think, did that continue for you right through to the end?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, in all fairness, like, I will never return to read a Polarity comic book again. I really didn't like the dialogue. It really didn't work for me. And then essentially where they went with the character, you know, at the end, it also didn't work for me. I mean, basically nothing in the story worked for me.
Really? I think it's really interesting to see this character who discovers he has these superpowers when he's manic, a bipolar character, discovers he has these superpowers when he's manic, written by a singer. We've never written anything before, except for music. What's his name? Max Bemis of Say Anything, who himself almost lost the band Say Anything, his entire musical career, because of his own bipolar disorder. I think that's key to all of this. He himself, for years, Max Say Anything, he was like 17 when they started. We were 19 to sign to a record label. By the time he's 20, because of his own bipolarism, the band is broken up. I think that's key to this whole thing. So, I mean, I don't think that this is all phony. I think this is all a very, very personal storyline. I think this dialogue really, especially towards the end, I love the idea that this character gets these powers, so he decides to be a superhero. So his superhero act is to go out on stage and reveal that this singer out here is a phony because he can read minds. And then she's a fake. Like, she's not as cool as she's saying. To him, that's how these people need to be rescued. These people that are idealizing these phony media characters. And then, of course, he starts doing some more actual superhero memes, and it ramps up to an action-packed finale, which it didn't seem to be leaning towards, but it kind of ramped up to me nicely. Like, I was highly impressed by this book. I think this is a really, really strong book.
I'm going to get outside of reviews. One thing I will say about Polarity is that it's quite indicative of what Boom is doing right now. You know, you talk about, and Mo, you've said that Image is the new Vertigo. Well, Boom may be the new Image, or maybe it's the new Dark Horse. They're trying stuff. Sometimes they don't stick the landing. You know, for this book, they were really reaching. I know the book really connected with a lot of people, but ultimately there's no second level to this story for me. It doesn't pay off into anything. The level below the surface is, just more surface. But I think it's realistic. I think he is telling an honest story. And, you know, I credit them for trying this kind of thing, because we're not seeing this kind of work from anyone else. Whether it's perfect or not, is a different question, but it's certainly reaching.
I have a couple of points I want to make on that. Number one, it's funny, because Brett and I earlier in the day were talking about how, I knew Dynamite's strategy. I know Image's strategy. I know Marvel's strategy. I wasn't 100% Boom's strategy, because when you look at their catalog, we're trying to pick a book, and we say this is really the only miniseries, and so much of their catalog is actually, Adventure Time and these books, and then a few licensed properties, and it seems like they do a lot of everything. So I wasn't 100% sure, but I'll say a few things. Number one, I think you nailed it there. Maybe they are the new Dark Horse. Maybe they are trying something. I think, you talk about this connected to some people. Max Bemis is 29 years old, and I think the people that follow him as a general rule are younger than that still, that are fans of his, and we're all 40-year-old guys. So, in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, where this is set in a different type of city and for a different age, that might have affected it. I suffer from social anxiety disorder, where if I'm not taking my medication, I don't function at all. I wouldn't be here doing this with you. I would have no life at all, basically. It's severe enough if I don't take my medication. So maybe the fact that I have that kind of gave me a different perspective also on reading this than you guys. That's possible as well. And one of the reasons why I might have enjoyed it more than you. I think you're right on Boom. I also think the idea just though that this guy comes out, he's with a band that has had top 40 hits and has a following, and he wants to do a comic book, and he's talking about it at the concerts, and people will try it, is again just a kind of a signal of the comic books are getting a little momentum in terms of quality, the type of stories you could tell, what people are expectations, and just the coolness level of comic books right now that I feel is kind of just in the public consciousness, kind of, ramping up a little bit. So thoughts either one of you on that? On anything I said?
I think certainly that this book did connect with people who have had their own health challenges. I saw a lot of that on Twitter. And opening a dialogue about that, it's representing the superpower stuff aside. It really represents the manic nature of what he's going through. It represents the disconnect from reality. The highs and lows of his confidence level, the way he interacts with people, all of that really seems to represent very honestly. And I think that connected with people. And that level of the story I really liked. I think that for me, when I got to the end of the story, I wanted the story to be I hate when I hear this phrase, but I think it is what it implies. I wanted it to be about something different than it was when I got to the end. I not necessarily a swerve, but I wanted it to be more about that this was his way of seeing the world, not that he really does have superpowers.
There was a point where I thought that's where they're going to. They was going to wake up, and I thought it was all going to be revealed as being in his mind, and then it wasn't. Not to give any spoilers, but that's a spoiler. Post spoiler spoiler.
It's not all a dream.
Yeah.
Is that a spoiler?
I think that, for myself, when you said earlier about it, him being 29 and his fans probably being less, I think that in my case and probably in all of our cases, it's one of those scenarios where if you had written, like for us, when we were 29 years old or 25 years old, I mean, I certainly remember all the slacker Gen X style comedies that were coming out. And I mean, we ate those up like crazy. And I think this is kind of the same thing. It's just not for our generation.
I think there's something to that for sure. Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, Brett, why don't you talk about Strain? one of the things I like, because Keith unfortunately didn't get a chance to read this, and I hope you really do still, Keith, if you get an opportunity. Unfortunately, those people who you work for are real meanies and don't let you read at work when you're supposed to be working. Not that ours do, Brett.
No, but, they don't let us, but
they're not listening.
They don't walk by and go, "Hey, why aren't you reading the comic books? Don't you have a podcast to do?"
Yeah. I tell them, actually, I do say that. I say it like at lunch, you know, "You've got to leave me alone. I've got comics to read."
My coworkers just, if I bring up comics, it will lead to an automatic conversation about Big Bang Theory. Now, I enjoy Big Bang Theory. I find the show humorous. But it's not the conversation I want to have anytime comics.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the difference, Keith. You won't say to the people you work with, "You got to leave because I got to read comics." Whereas Brett doesn't care if the people he works with hate him. And he doesn't give a damn. "You don't like me? I don't care. I got to read comics." You don't want that.
That's fair.
You're normal.
To be fair, I don't care what they think of Brandon. but they don't buy my editor's making me read comics.
So anyways, let's talk about Strain, Brett. Like you say, one of the things I like here is that we got a good sample also of books that were different things. A little bit of superheroes, you know, something that's horror here. Then we got some mystery and thrillers, and we got in our different books and with different genres, we got different, you know, different feels definitely from every publisher. And yes, so Strain, I mean, it's who was it that did this book, Brett? I'm going to mispronounce the name.
Guillermo del Toro.
That's what I said. And Chuck Hogan. It's based on, of course, del Toro. Just has a huge hit now with Pacific Rim. And Chuck Hogan was the co-author of the books that these are based on. But I understand that David Lapham and Mike Caldelson, who actually did the actual book here, had quite a bit of freedom within the world to tell this story in their own way. So what did you think of Strain?
Well, I mean, there's a lot in this set. You know, it's one of those cases where I generally have a problem. I have a problem with two things, like right off the bat in the story, that kind of hold me back. I don't like vampires very much, and I don't like reading comic books based on novels very much, because often they're just not, you know, they're just not very good. But this one, you know, kind of managed after a little while to like take both of those right out of the equation for me. And I think that's the best thing that I have to say about these, is that I really grew to care about the characters in all cases in this. And I think that, you know, the first volume is 12, and I think there's going to be three volumes that will all be 12 issues. And so I read the first 12 and the first issue of the second one, but I mean, primarily we're talking about the first one, and I think that the characters are really good. Like it reads like it is taken from a novel, but that's not in a bad way. You know, it's actually kind of a good way. It's got that same kind of, you know, like the different characters are popping up at different points, but it's okay because when they come in, I'm actually kind of happy because it's just like, "Oh, this character's back. That's great." You know, and I don't normally get that from a lot of comic books.
No, it had a lot of time for characterization, obviously, with it, with 12 issues. I think one of the things, there's a couple things. I'm with you. I'm not really big on vampires, you know, and, or, you know, comic books based on books or generally properties at all, as a general rule. I agree with you. I think one of the things that's a strength here, Brett, is these issues aren't the vampires that we're used to. They have different strengths and weaknesses, and there's a logic kind of that they explain scientifically things about these vampires that made them seem not like the vampires of lore, but just like a something else different or fresh that I hadn't encountered before. The fact that these vampires, and it is a strain. That's the other thing, is you could have taken the vampires out of this and it still would have worked just fine as an outbreak type story, a story about the strain and and the spread of the disease and the virus type deal.
Yeah, it totally could have been zombies or anything like that. Yeah.
Or anything like that. It could have been just a virus without any, you know, supernatural element, so to speak, at all. The fact that they threw that in there made that cool, though, I think helps. I think the thing is that this story, like the opening prologue section, is so cool and original. I like it so much that just draws me into the whole world. I feel like, oh, okay, this isn't like the things that annoy me about a vampire. This is going to be fresh and different. I'm highly impressed by this book, and you can't help but read this and go, Jesus, this would make a great TV show or you know, something like that. Like it also, while it was a novel first, it would so well transfer into many mediums, I think.
Yeah, I would. It's the kind of thing where I would really like to see the entire thing. Like it now, it's kind of a shame for me right now because I think about it. Like I have to wait. What is essentially another 2 years?
2 years spread is killing me because this was. I'm like, oh no.
And then to read it all in one fell swoop. You know, essentially all 12 issues within the span of 2 days for me. And
by the time those 36 issues are out, you know it should be fantastic.
Yeah.
Like it'll be so worth the weekend.
I definitely hope that it maintains it, and I see no reason why it wouldn't in this regard. But, you know, I mean, they're telling a quality story. They're telling it with quality characters. And I think it really does show that they are given enough leeway to go off where they feel the need to go off. And tell it in a comic book way. You know, it's not just, you know, how some directors are given the leeway or whatever to go off on their own. You know, Christopher Nolan with the Batman story and stuff like that. This is one of those cases where, you know, comic book creators have been given that like, hey, yes, turn this into a comic book. Do it. You're the pro at the comic books. You do it.
Well, I mean, it's like, Brett, it's like, you know, they always say Walking Dead. You can read the comic book, you can read the novels, you can watch the TV show. They all have something different. They're not going to have a lot of spoilers ruining things for you. I get the feeling this is the same type of idea. I don't think that if you read this and then read the novel, I get the feeling they'll actually complement each other in the world and you'll have the same feel, but not. I mean, I am planning to read the novels now, but I am still probably planning to read them after 2 more years and I've read all the comics, but still. Because I don't want to take a chance that this experience is ruined for me because it was a really good experience.
It's true, yeah. I mean, this was top two, like, for me. Like, there was about, you know, End of Days was really good. Planet Death, probably still my favorite, but this was right up there.
Yeah, no, really, really good stuff. Well, let's move on then. Keith, let's talk about End of Days. You were kind of praising it highly earlier. Tell everybody a little bit more about what it is that hit you so much with it.
I think I really recently reread Miller's Daredevil, and End of Days is touching on really the greatest runs, not just Miller's. You know, the use of Typhoid Mary in this story. For those who haven't come across it, Daredevil End of Days is the last Daredevil story. Matt Murdock dies in the first issue of this story, and it's an 8-issue. With Ben Urich. I can never remember which one's which. Ben Urich investigating in a very obvious nod to Citizen Kane, the meaning of Matt Murdock's last word.
Well, yeah, he. I mean, in the first issue, I think somebody says, "Are we sure it isn't a sled?"
Yeah,
there was a nod. Yeah.
Yeah, they wear that on a sleeve. I mean, they use also the premise, the structure of Citizen Kane where, Urich goes from person to person, those who were closest to Daredevil, to Matt Murdock, to try to find out not only what does this word mean, but to understand where Daredevil was for a gap that he had killed someone and then disappeared for a number of years.
Kills
Kingpin, and then he disappears for like 5 years, I think it says, for a number of years, and then reappears. So he goes from person to person, kind of collecting these pieces of who Daredevil was. And I think it's what I really liked about this book was that it had those nods to so many of the great runs, but at the same time, it didn't feel like a compilation or like a best of. A lot of these runs I haven't read. I haven't read Bendis's Daredevil, or let alone Brubaker's. And, so my Daredevil really goes back to Ann Nesenti and Miller.
Ditto.
And that kind of era. But there was plenty for me to understand in that. And the bits I didn't, I could pick up. I mean, there was a lot of Miller in there. The use of the character Turk, the tough guy character, all through Miller's run. Certainly Elektra's role in the story. Yurik was a prominent character in Miller's run, but it really felt like it will sit really well on the shelf with Miller's books, the same way that, you know, Dark Knight Returns and Year One sit well together. It was just a really, really strong book, and it's the kind of thing that DC used to do better. You know, this is a miniseries that it's not in continuity. No one gives a crap if it's gonna ever be in continuity. It's just telling a really, really good story with really, really great creators.
It's you know, I think you nailed a lot of it there, Keith. Like, it's really a noir mystery story. Like, if you're looking for a superhero story, you've gone to the wrong place. You're not going to get it at all from this book. There's very little superhero stuff or even action. I mean, it's really about the exploration of the mystery. I think Ben Urich is one of the best supporting characters in comic book history, underappreciated and underused. And he's so good here. And he's so likable. And he carries the story. And it's really more his story than Daredevil's. And, here's this jaded reporter who still has a very strong moral code in a world where they're basically admitting he has no place anymore because nobody reads newspapers. And he goes out to tell the story. And many artists worked on this. Klaus Janson is the main artist, but many artists work on it. It's really just, I feel there's kind of a reveal and a decision made about a character who ends up playing a far more prominent role towards the end that to me was a little bit of a forced thing. And it hurt the miniseries for me a little bit. And I think you guys know what character I'm talking about and what he ended up being and how it kind of came together. And I go back and read it with the other stuff and the earlier issues, I don't know that it quite fits for me. And so I think that actually brought it down from being the best thing I read of all this stuff, but it's still a really damn good story.
I think the thing is that this one has, and I will agree with you, Mo, and I also will totally say that you stole exactly what I was going to say about Yurik. You know, Yurik is just one of those characters that, you know, when he gets used, Marvel actually doesn't go too wrong. When he is the main character, like Civil War, there was so much about Civil War that wasn't very good. But one of the things that was good was Civil War Frontline, you know, that Ben Urich was the key player in. And I think that, you know, he's a character that they can really use to tell great stories. And this totally has those same elements of being a great story. Sure, you know, like the ending, you know, it's probably a little more comic booky than we may have actually preferred. But the book itself is just so consistent. You know, the art, despite being different artists, remains consistent. The storytelling remains completely consistent, and it is consistent quality throughout.
I mean, barring Michael Bendis writes this, David Mack co-writes this, Bendis doesn't get too cute on this one. He does give me a couple actual laughs when I didn't expect it, which I appreciated it because it was a very gritty story. I look at Brian Michael Bendis. I'm going to steal something from Chris, our missing co-host. He often talks about Peter David, how there's a good writer and it's Peter, and there's a bad writer who's David. I think there's a good writer who's Brian, and there's a bad writer who's Michael. And this is Brian.
Yeah, and the Sienkiewicz finished art is just amazing. You know, the pages where it feels so Sienkiewicz.
There's a visceral energy to some of the violence in this book that they portray in the art that is really stunning.
And I think that this, I mean, again, getting back to the level of a company, this is the kind of stuff that the best stuff at Marvel is right now, is the stuff that's not bogged down in continuity. And unfortunately, the continuity sells at the big two. So, you know, this stuff doesn't always hit the top 10. But you know, Wade's Daredevil, which is just on doing its own thing in general. Remender's Captain America, I think that those are the best, some of the best stuff coming from Marvel right now. I mean, Superior Spider-Man started as its own thing, and they've just kind of built out from it without drawing in a big crossover or anything. They've just slowly added on to it as it's been successful. That's what's working for them. And this kind of book, End of Days, is also in that vein of just tell a really, really good story. And, you know, don't worry so much about how it fits into the grander scheme.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the fact that they're doing that. I mean, I enjoy Savage Wolverine too, and it just does that, right? Just go tell the story. Let's move on here, Brett. We're going to talk about a book called Snapshot, but Keith did not read this. But Keith is the one who convinced us to add this to the grouping of this week. So what was it that you wanted to add Snapshot in, Keith?
I quite enjoy Andy Diggle. This was already on my reading pile. And it was a miscommunication that I was not sure whether we were doing this one or one of the other Image books, Five Weapons. So I read, not that I finished Five Weapons either. I read
Why don't we just leave Five Weapons off then? Why don't we, Mo and I will just talk about Snapshot and then we'll just move on from there, and we'll leave Five Weapons for another day.
Yeah, we'll leave Five Weapons for another day. I just want to say I love Five Weapons.
Yeah, I mean, it's top of my list. I mean, it's,
yeah, Five I can't Weapons wait.
Is a great series.
In January 2014, when the ongoing comes out, I'm going to be all over that, like you wouldn't believe. So, Snapshot, Brett. I mean, I enjoy Andy Diggle's work. I've had some misses from him, but as a general rule, I think he's a good writer. Jock does the art on this too, and despite the fact that I have to get over the fact that his name is simply Jock, he certainly does a nice job too. I thought Snapshot is also has a lot of mystery elements, but it's far more of an action thriller mystery than the noir gritty reality mystery that Daredevil kind of is. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Snapshot is one of those. It's all swerves all the time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of action sequences and a lot of, you know, Hitchcocky and MacGuffin in there, and originally conceived as a movie script, and you definitely see that in it. One of those things that works as a comic book, and not everybody realizes that it does. Like it's a really, you know, I don't know how many people ended up reading this, and that's kind of a shame. Jock does a great job just conveying, like I say, that frantic energy. The constant adrenaline energy of the nervousness that the characters are feeling in the situation, because the world is constantly chasing them and on their about to collapse around them, and there doesn't seem to be any solution. And really interesting, a story that unravels at a really interesting pace and makes total sense, but has a lot going on.
Yeah, it has. My opinion on this one is that I actually found that it has. I think it has too much going on. Like,
that's possible, yeah.
For me, this one's in the bottom of my list. Like, I thought that I understand. Like, Andy Diggle and Jock work really well together, and I think that they have something good going on. And definitely, you know, when you talk about the manic energy, and I think this is one that even if I read again, I would get more out of, and I would probably appreciate it even more having read it the first time. But I think that on the first read, there's so much going on that I actually just kind of checked out a little bit, and I didn't.
If there's if you're not going to read it all in one sitting, or you're going to have any distractions, it's definitely going to hurt you on this one.
Yeah.
And didn't these guys though? Did they do Diggle
the Losers
and Jock the Losers, yeah, which I didn't read and I didn't see. It became a film property. Is that correct?
Yeah. Actually, I like the film. I think the film's fun.
Yeah. Have you seen the film or read The Losers, Keith?
I've seen the film. I didn't like it. So I've only read a couple of issues to come.
Well, either way, I mean, I want to go and check that out after reading this for sure. But then again, I like Diggle quite a bit. His work generally really works for me.
It's a very cool concept. Like, the concept itself is really totally out there. It's totally something different. And that I absolutely appreciate. I appreciate the fact that he's trying to do something different. He's trying to tell this story that you wouldn't normally think of. But again, it's also
and you wouldn't think of in a comic book. Like, yeah, you say, an action mystery thriller. You don't think of that in a comic book. But it does. I mean, I think he manages to keep. There's a sense in these type of movies when you're reading them that there's always a sense that somebody's just, you know, grinding the gears of the characters. Like, they're always on edge, and that's what I think Jock does a really good job of portraying in the art here.
Yeah, the only thing that I will say is that the dialogue in the comic book store I thought was completely lame.
Maybe, but. You know what? It's funny because this is a book. I mean, this book and Strain both contain quite a bit of profanity. Polarity contains none, despite feeling just as set for a mature audience. And that may be because Max Bemis is actually a born again Christian, but it has just as mature a slant as these do. But it doesn't contain any profanity at all. I just think that's an interesting. I didn't have trouble with the profanity in these because it was organic to the story, whereas one of the books we're going to have in a Wii View, I'll get into it, but I feel it was completely unnecessary and didn't add anything to the story, but we'll get there in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a good book. You know, like I said, another solid read for me.
All right, just a couple more, and we'll move on to our reviews then. What do you want to touch on? Who wants Green Arrow? Who wants Edison Rex?
I'll talk about Green Arrow. So, Jeff Lemire's Green Arrow, and this book has struggled. I think this is the fourth creative team we've had on this book since it relaunched. It was one of the more risky relaunches for the New 52, not for the recognition of the character, but because it was one of the more extreme revamps, taking a character who, for our entire lives, has been the grumpy old man and made him 25 years old. And which they had chosen to do, you know, long before the TV show was on the air. And then as they're doing this kind of soft reboot, the big fear was that they were going to try to do just the TV show. And there's elements of that. There's certainly an awareness that some people are going to be coming to this book, having known the TV show, but not anything else. But it's just really well done. The art is really cool. They're setting up, a lot of long-term stuff and, you know, going higher level to DC. I think that is a good description of a lot of what has happened at DC over the past 2 years. The idea that they were going to go one direction when in fact they're setting long-term plans. They have very specific directions for a lot of characters and a lot of books. You know, when Pandora number one came out and then the first part of Trinity War last week, we saw that stuff that was in literally in the first panels of the first book of the New 52 are tying in now. And that all of these threads finally pay off. And now Green Arrow is starting its own threads, things that could be months or years to play out how all of these tribes, they call them tribes, right? How all of these will tie together eventually and who will represent them, etc. It's long-term stuff and but it's true serialized. I mean, that's one of the challenges of finding something for DC. For us to read is that, you know, Brett doesn't read a lot of DC. Mo's not reading DC except for one, maybe two titles. And it was really hard going through the stack to find something that wasn't pure serial. So much of DC is, it's not part one of four. It is issue 22 of however long it runs. It is a full on serial. It's like finding an arc of a soap opera. So I love what they've done here. I love that they've kept at Arrow trying to make it work, and it finally is.
You know, it's interesting that you say that it finally is, because for me, it now isn't. A lot of those reasons that you're actually saying, you know, like with the concept of the tribes and stuff like that, and the fact that it's this really, really long story. I get that. I appreciate that. But for me, I want a little bit more payoff with the character before, because as it stands right now, when I read this, I'm reading it as a superhero book, and I'm reading it as a common superhero book. There's nothing uncommon about it. It's just completely a run-of-the-mill superhero book that the storyline could last for, you know, 2 or 3 years on. And I think that if I got a little more payoff, I might feel that I could carry on. But I'm struggling, you know, on getting that payoff right now. I don't, like, the art, I think, is really good. Like, it's funny, because the art, it almost reminds me of a Marvel, you know, of, like, say, a Daredevil book in that case. But I think that it's actually Lemire's writing. Like, I'm not that big a fan of his superhero work.
Keith, why don't you go ahead and respond to that?
I don't know, I'd say for want of a better term, Brett's a Marvel and I'm a DC. I think that exactly what Brett said could very easily be said by me about a Hickman book. I think if you have the desire to put in the time and you want to continue with this kind of story, like, I mean, a soap opera is the best example, because we all understand what that means. That it will pay off is kind of the wrong phrase, because to pay off, it needs to come to some kind of conclusion. And a lot of these books, and, you know, in a lot of Hickman's stuff, doesn't necessarily. A lot of Bendis' stuff doesn't. It is not designed to tell a 12-issue or even a 50-issue story. It is designed to continue on until he's tired of telling that one story. And yeah, I think my desire to invest in an ongoing serial at Marvel is probably the same level as Brett's desire to do so at DC.
I see that to a certain degree. Hickman's a good example for sure. I mean, it's usually the things along the way, like, you know, when you reach a certain point, and I think that in this case it was with Komodo that you kind of saw that first part of the story wrap up, and ultimately it was, I think that I was kind of with it up until that point, but I didn't really enjoy the wrap up of the early wrap up of Komodo in this case. And I didn't necessarily like maybe where it was going after that. You know, when you talk about Marvel, I mean, it's kind of funny, because with Hickman, I tend to stay off of it for a while and then read giant batches. And perhaps maybe that's the best thing that I could do with this run as well, is like sit back on it for a good solid year and then just completely read it all within that year.
You know, we first read this, the first issue of this, with Lemire taking over. So we reviewed that for our WeViews. And at the time, I really, really liked it. And I decided, that's it. I'm finally collecting a Marvel book, a DC book again after a year and a half of not collecting anything from DC after their relaunch in the New 52 and just not connecting to it. And so this book had for me a lot of high hopes that I would hope it would draw me back into the DC universe as a whole. And now I'm getting I've dropped the book. I'm getting Stormwatch. I got the first couple issues of Venditti, This one to me is a story where at first I said, it reminds me a lot of Miller's Daredevil, but that's good because I like Miller's Daredevil. And it did, and then it reminded me, and it continued to remind me of Daredevil, and it continued to remind me a little bit of Grell. And then we get to that final part of the storyline on this island and all these tribes, and all this stuff's being explained to me, Keith. And I'm going, yeah, I read this before in Iron Fist. And at no point in time did I feel like this was a Lemire's Green Arrow or a real Green Arrow or the real Oliver Queen or original in any way. And never, as much as you try and put a fresh coat of paint on it and do whatever you can't make it as interesting as the character they've taken away. And I wasn't against them taking it away. You'll go back to the first issue when we talk about the Zero issue wasn't very good. But the issue number one, I said, oh, they've reinvented Green Arrow. I didn't have a problem with it if it was well done. But at the end of the day, I just think that they're still missing. You've lost an interesting character. And this stuff isn't interesting to me when I feel like I'm – I feel like it's all retreads from other stories I've seen elsewhere better.
Well, it's interesting because I think that when we talk about the next comic book, it's one of the, in Edison Rex, it's one of those cases where they're taking, you know, these already designed characters and then they're kind of flipping them on their side to help propel their storyline. And I think that that's kind of what I wanted in Green Arrow, is I wanted Lemire to kind of flip Green Arrow on his side and maintain some of the core elements, but tell his own storyline. And I don't feel like I'm getting that.
Yeah, I was really, like I say, I mean, I put it down and I went, I can't believe that was the final issue of this first story arc. I'm just so disappointed. I'm done. It's too bad. Let's move on to Edison Rex. You know, I think, for me, I was pleasantly surprised by this. Again, we did another review of the first one. I really liked it. But, I mean, if you're a fan of DC, if you're familiar with you know, the Superman character, all this will seem familiar to you. But it isn't super – like, it takes everything that is a familiar archetype. And I think one thing that's interesting is we always see this. We see archetype tales told and flipped and told in different ways like this or Red 10 now. And it's always the DC character archetypes and not the Marvel characters archetypes, it seems. And I don't know what that says. Maybe you guys will get into that a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, if you're familiar with Superman, you can take this basically, I mean, yes, Lex Luthor wins and then realizes now it's his responsibility to protect the Earth. And there's so much – this is just so much fun. It's got this retro feel. It's got this cool art style. It's well written. Everything is a self-contained story that's just a blast to read and talk about, and I think Edison Rex is a real gem.
I've been a big fan of Edison Rex from the start. It was one of my favorite Monkey Brain books, and for exactly that, I mean, I think archetype is the right word here. You know, we've reviewed a lot of analog books over the years, over the year. It seems like so much more than a year.
Oh, come on. We've been doing this for 2 years now.
Is it almost 2 years? Oh,
it's over two, years, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Remember, we've had specials. We had a little break there at one point where we weren't regularly. We were only doing a couple shows a month. So, yeah, but we have.
And it is over the years.
Yes.
Yeah. It's over the many, many years. over the eons.
Zero issues, a couple point ones. Yeah.
We never should have renumbered. That's why no one can keep track.
Yeah, we should start to get, you know what, when we actually, have we officially hit 2 years? Because if we do, we're renumbering at one again.
We've got to reboot. And
a soft relaunch, really.
Chris will be a hot blonde woman because I know he digs when there's gender swaps when they do a reboot. But it's not a, and we've reviewed a lot of books that are, analogs. And this isn't an analog. There's elements from Superman, but Edison Rex very much isn't Lex Luthor. He is an archetypal evil scientist, but he's much more buff than Luthor ever was. He's a different sort of approach, for how he sees the world. And I really like the premise of this book. You know, that concept that you know, he kills the hero and then has to accept that someone was watching over things. So, but I'm going to do, I mean, it's almost Superior Spider-Man.
I was about to make that. Did this come out before Superior Spider-Man? Because there is something to that.
It did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had started, it started last fall, I want to say. But yeah, it is that same approach of what if the hero isn't thinking it through as much as, you know, a smarter person would. You know, Edison Rex is just brighter than the hero he's replacing.
You know, and you mentioned he's not Lex Luthor, and you're right. I mean, he uses these characters that feels like Lex Luthor when you first start him. It feels like a Superman, and you show up, and there's a Brainiac-type character. But he uses them as a launching point to tell totally different stories with totally different characters. Like, they seem familiar, and then there's a lot of layers laid out for you by Chris Roberson that makes it a lot of, you know, a different experience.
And that is completely where the book succeeds, is the fact that you have a certain familiarity with these with the archetypes, but when he goes off on his own, I think it's one of those cases where you're already involved with the character. You don't actually need to go back and have every origin story retold for you per se. I mean, you're actually involved with the character, and just the fact that he's telling these different stories is fine. And that doesn't bother you in that same regard. You know, if somebody tried to tell you this with Lex Luthor and Superman, you'd be pissed off.
Absolutely. It's the advantage of something like that.
But it's different even than in the case of the Red Ten, you know, because those are staying as those same archetypes. Whereas in this case, I mean, it was the archetypes gave you the introduction, but now they're kind of gone.
Well, you know what? By the time that the Red Ten finishes in 2047, we might find that the characters aren't quite staying like that. But
oh, absolutely.
Knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Edison Rex is a fine example of a way that they're telling superhero books in this mold, I think, and Monkey Brain's done a really good job with a lot of their books, and I mean, you know, hats off to Roberson for pulling this one out because
that's the other thing. We said, okay, we're going to take a book from every major publisher. And Monkey Brain was now a major publisher. Monkey Brain was now one of the ones that's like, we can't do this without Monkey Brain. We didn't have something from Oni, but we couldn't do this without Monkey Brain.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, do we want to do Edison Rex? Do we want to do Masks and Mobsters? Do we, you know, like, there was stuff that was on the list.
All right, are you guys ready to move on to some Wii Views?
Let's Wii View some books.
Damn it, Brett, start with your first. Oh, what was that?
I think rather than reviewing some damn books, we should save you from bad comics.
Oh, that's right, Keith, because we're...
Here I come to save the day.
Saving you from bad comics.
You said...
Well,
Brett, you drop in this save the day twice.
That was an epic fail. That right there.
Hey, Brett. It's the Wii. Time for Brett.
I'm condescendingly Brett. Saving you from bad comments.
Brett, it's time for the Wii Views because we're...
Here I come to save the day.
Saving you from bad comics.
Damn it, Keith, that's how it's done.
Unfortunately, we're not saving you from bad comic book hosts, but...
Strain number one, we've already kind of talked about that, so let's move on. Keith, did you have a chance to read Dino Attack from IDW?
I did not. Were there dinosaurs in it?
Yeah, they attacked. Brett?
Nice.
That's right.
We put it in there just for you because the artist, making a return, one of your all-time favorites. I mean, you love this guy. Herb Trimp.
Herb Trimpy.
Yep, there you go. I thought that...
Longbox will lose it if we don't call him Trimpy.
All right, Trimpy.
Herb Trimpy. Finishes by Canadian treasure, George Freeman.
There you go.
Well, that's excellent. You know, it's interesting with this book. Obviously, Keith's not really going to talk about it. There's it actually, it starts out looking completely like a 1980s, you know, probably an independent style book, moves off at certain points to become like a 1970s style throwback book, but the script stays completely based in the 1980s. And the script really should have stayed in the 1980s, along with the art style. And oh man, I wish I had never read this book. I wish that this book hadn't even come up on my radar, because it took me so long to read this book, and there was just no real good payoff that oh it's so bad. Oh, this
Holy God, is this ever 80s.
Oh man, it's just, you know, I had to look. I actually had to look to see if it was something that they originally like did way back in the 80s and finally published today for no good reason, and no.
I got to tell you, I thought it was it felt to me like a late 1960s gold key book, is what I thought when I'm reading it. I'm like, this thing's stuck in a time warp.
Oh, it's totally right, stuck right. in a time warp.
It's stuck. This thing is from another era, and it's not good. It'd be one thing if it was another era and it was a great book that was from another era. It's a below average book that's from another era.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, and yeah, I mean, the art isn't particularly good. No. Though we don't notice his feet.
No, that's kind of true.
But the writing's not, like, it's not good. But here's the thing about me, Brett. It's called Dino Attack. Dinosaurs attack on what page?
Oh, it must be like, you know, page 300.
Yeah, exactly. If you have a book called Dino Attack, to quote Chris Beck, the dinosaurs should attack on page one.
Well, and in all fairness, the dinos attacking seem to be just a completely secondary notion to the storyline. This is called Dino Attack, I think, only to maintain it with, like, the kind of Mars Attacks, you know, like, thing that IDW has going on. Oh, and that kind of thing.
I am gonna jump in on one thing. A Dinosaur's Attack is the full title. There was actually a card set. So some of the artwork, the more painted stuff that you see,
yes,
is actually stuff. From a card set called Dino. It's from a card set it was from Topps. So it was a thematic sequel to Mars Attacks called Dinosaurs Attack. But yes, it told that. And so some of the stuff, some of the elements of this issue are actually from that card set. I had that card set. I never had the Mars Attacks.
And, you know, it's funny, though, because it feels actually more disjointed. And, you know, that now that you mention that, I completely understand why it's disjointed. Because it's like they had a comic book and they suddenly said, hey, we've got this card set. Can you like, shoehorn it into your comic book? Oh, okay.
They didn't have 55 covers to this one, though.
Nope. That's good. But they shouldn't have one.
More is the
thing. No, it never should have happened. Brett, let's move on here to Blood Brothers from Dark Horse. That's right. Dark Horse gives us Blood Brothers, number one, by Mike Gagerman and Andrew Walker. Story by Eaton Cohen. Art by Evan Shaner. A lot of people working on it, Keith.
Well, who's jumping on?
I don't care.
I don't know. He said Keith, so I was going to talk.
Let me talk.
Go ahead.
Man, I really like this book. I think it's really, really funny. This is a funny, funny book. I like the dialogue. I like the interplay between the characters. I like the slight twist on a familiar story. I really enjoyed it. I wish it didn't have so much unnecessary F words. Like, it's totally unnecessary. It didn't make the book any better. It ruined the book for me. It honestly ruined the book for me. Like I say, because it wasn't organic to the storyline or the characters. It just seemed this was a story that in every way could have been given to anybody of any age, except for the characters are constantly cursing. And it really is too bad, because other than that, it's terrific. And profanity doesn't bother me. If anybody's listened to We Talk Wrestling, it's basically a 90-minute F-bomb. But nevertheless,
I think you probably have to cut the orgy scene as well.
Well, that's true. that's true. But even that's not overly graphic in showing things. Like, it's showing, obviously, they're boning, but it's kind of from the side, and you see maybe a butt cheek. You don't really see much, like, It's a little bit adult, but yeah, it's really, I don't know, man. It's too bad it ruined, I think, because it just felt thrown on just for the sake of throwing it on. It's too bad because it's a really funny book. I really think it's well done otherwise.
Well, I'll go next. I think that this would have been a really great special. But I don't think there's a whole lot to these characters. I didn't feel like it was enough new for me. And,
well, he felt like this guy had watched Clerks 47 times beforehand. And then he made Randall and Dante vampires. Because that's exactly what these two characters are. They're Randall and Dante as vampires.
That's not a bad analogy. It's a lot of clever dialogue. It took three guys to do this story.
I know.
For some clever. That's two writers and a story by credit. It's just fine. It's nothing special. It's got a couple of giggles. If I never read it at $4, it's a little steep for a couple of giggles and not a lot of substance. Brett.
I'll be honest. I hate this book. I hate the dialogue. I hate the fact that it's another vampire story. You know, the buddy-buddy thing is just totally lost on me in this case. It's like, when you say clever, when you say, you know, like Dante and Randall, I'm like, yeah, these guys are just, they're just plucking crap and trying to lay it into a vampire story. And for me, it's just totally doesn't work. And yeah, I mean, you talk about the volume of swears and stuff like that, and it's just like, I mean, it just pushed it way too far for where I ever wanted to go. And so, well, you know, another bad one.
Yeah. All right, Keith, you get the chance to talk first about Gail Simone or Walter Giovanni doing Red Sonja from Dynamite. Number one.
All right. If you guys are listening to this in the car, John, please distract Matt and jump past this point. I was talking to someone on Twitter the other day about writers that you just cannot get into, even though everyone else seems to love them. And mine is Gail Simone, because I hear some super fans of Gail Simone talk like her writing heals the sick and feeds the masses. That when she writes a comic, it's loaves and fishes. I don't think I've ever read a Gail Simone book that connected with me on any level that wasn't more, that was okay. And this was okay. The character didn't do anything for me. She never has. She doesn't now. The storytelling was really, really disjointed. It jumps around excessively for no real reason. It had a great starting point, and that starting point is page like six or six or seven, as opposed to, you know, where it actually starts. If it started at a different point, was structured a different way, but it just jumps around so much, I had trouble following the order of the story and why the story wasn't just in a normal order. There wasn't anything dramatically that was requiring it to be in the order it was. It was just shuffled for the sake of shuffling it. I will not be returning to this Dynamite book that does all of the things that I said Dynamite does too much of earlier in the episode.
This is, you know what, this is, Gail Simone is, you talk about how people talk about how she, her books heal the sick and whatever. I mean, that's it. She has a rabid cult fan base. She's never had a top seller. She's a subpar talent who's overrated because those people who really like her so much. She's completely overrated. She's told some good stories. I think Welcome to Tranquility is really good. I like that. And then she's told some average ones, and this is a below average one. This book peaks at the cover. This storyline is completely uninspired. The dialogue is completely ill-fitting the book. It has nothing that makes you. This is about a 4, 3.5 out of 10 as a book. Like, it feels like C.L. Simone is just phoning it into me And she's not taking the character. Like, if she was to write a parody about Red Sonja, this is the book she'd do. But instead, it's actually Red Sonja. And if she's not taking it seriously, how can I? Brett?
Well, this was like, you know, what happens when you take a comic book writer and you take them out of their safe zone and you put them into something else and they don't have any good concepts and they don't have any real idea how to write the character. So they just write them how they kind of think the usual way that the character needs to be written is. And so, yeah, the storyline itself, there's really nothing there. What struck me immediately in this was just how truly awful the dialogue was. I just didn't, I was lost after three or four pages of trying to listen to these people talk, because it was just like, really, this is your concept of writing dialogue? I mean, I'd rather read Batgirl and that's saying something. You know, ultimately at the end, I'll even point out that the art, though the people looked relatively good, it was just such substandard sword and sorcery art styles. You know, like you have people who are basically float, like jumping around and floating in midair half the time, and that's what you expect to see in this kind of book. But again, you're not seeing anything original by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, but you have people on the internet that are basically saying that Gail Simone's Red Sonja is the best thing that they've read and is completely reinventing the character. And I'm like, that's a complete and utter lie. It's not reinventing the character at all. It's just telling a whole nother story with the same character, just not well.
Is it completely reinventing the character for people who've never read the character?
Well, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Good point, Keith.
I mean, I hate this book. Well,
I said she's overrated, Brett. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Keith doesn't connect with me either. Like, it's one of those cases, I tried reading Batgirl. And when I tried reading Batgirl, there was a point where I thought to myself, you know, okay, I see the story. You almost have me. But then I read a little bit further, and it's just like, I'm just out of the story. Gail Simone is what she is, and I think she's fantastic on Twitter. But
she's awesome on Twitter. Too bad she couldn't write as well in her books as she does on Twitter.
Yeah. If she could bottle up her Twitter feed and put it into a comic book, I'd probably read it.
And I do enjoy Batgirl. I find that I forget to get it every once in a while. And so I end up two or three issues back. But I've tried other stuff, and it's just fine.
It's just a comic book. It's just a comic book.
All right, let's get to, speaking of just a comic book, let's get into this week's main event, I think, even though Red Sonja was getting some, despite the quality, so a lot of internet buzz. But, I mean, Superior Carnage from Marvel is obviously the big book of the week, isn't it, gentlemen?
I would say so. It's part of Superior Month.
All right, give us your thoughts then, Keith.
It took me a bit to get into this book. Trying to remember where this character was last was a bit difficult. But Carnage about halfway USA. Through, was it Carnage USA is the last time we've seen this guy?
Yep. I think so.
Well, that's the last time. That might be the last time you read him. That's certainly not his last appearance. In fact, that's not even his last miniseries.
Oh, okay. Well, the last miniseries, then whatever that was, it was where I last remember him.
Yeah.
Carnage.
So, I mean, so far we don't know why he is superior Carnage. Whether it's just branding or whether this will roll in somehow to what's happening over there in Superior Spider-Man. It's an interesting book. I like the narrative style at the beginning of the other guy in prison, the guy who doesn't deserve to be in the Supermax prison. And I like the twist ending to the book. It's a five issue miniseries, like most of them have been. I'm probably in for it. I think it's a neat starting point to have Carnage so much on his back foot as the, when this story starts.
Minimum Carnage is the last.
Minimum.
And they Carnage, reference, yeah. They reference, of course, that's where he has the encounter with the Scarlet Spider.
I even read that, so you know, it's.
It tells you what you think of it.
Yeah.
No, I think Keith, you nailed it for me. I mean, I wish I probably could have enjoyed the book a lot more. I mean, I thought I saw that that twist at the end coming from a mile away. So I mean, didn't really do anything for me. But if you're gonna call it Superior Carnage, it's gotta be Superior Carnage. It can't just be a title just for, it's like back when they did Avengers Disassembled and they had 47 books that had nothing to do with it they were putting out. Like.
I don't agree with that, because I believe that I see where's the superior element in this case is going to come in. It just won't be this issue. Obviously. But
I don't see it coming in. I see it as just being another Carnage book given that title, and Carnage books are okay. But I don't see that the tie-in for me. I mean, that hurt it for me. I mean, it's part of Superior Month. Is it? I wish I could, I don't think it's a bad book. It's an average book that doesn't do as advertised for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he is going to be taken over by another character in this case. And that's where it will become the superior element will come in. You know, as to how much I like the book, I think that, you know, I think that the story's all right. It's probably not, it's certainly not spectacular in any way, shape, or form. There's a little too much, average humor for my taste in this case. One thing that I will say that really struck me was I thought that the art was really quite good, especially on Carnage.
Yeah, the art's decent. I mean, I'll just give the creators a message or their credit here, because it's Kevin Shinnick, Steven Segovia, and Jay Ramos. I'm not sure if these guys were working on the other Carnage. It is another fantastic Carnage cover. That's for damn sure. It's awesome.
Well, Clayton Crane, you know, he's been doing the Carnage covers for the most part, and I mean, he's done a fantastic job. I think that Zeb Wells wrote the Carnage miniseries. And honestly, I kind of, as much as I'm not a fan of him, I actually kind of like his stories a little bit more, I think, in the early case. I'd be interested just to see if it kind of goes the way I expect it to go. I'm not sure that I'd care to stick around for the whole thing, though.
Well, the thing is, it's never a character with a lot of depth, and it isn't meant to be.
No.
So, I mean, you have to accept that. Now, is this an ongoing, or is this another miniseries?
Five issues,
okay. All right. Well, interesting. All right, well, it sounds like, I mean, we had a few books that we would go as worst book. What's the best and worst book, then, of this week's reviews, guys?
Well,
that's a tough one this week.
Yeah,
I'm going to go Superior Carnage as my favorite book. I'm going to go with that Star Wars one that we didn't talk about as the worst book of the week.
It was horrible. It was awful.
It was so bad, we just didn't want to talk about it.
I didn't read it. I mean, I'm going to go, I'll give it a tie to Blood Brothers and Superior Carnage, because there was at least some stuff I enjoyed. But Red Sonja's worst book of the week, of course. Best book of the week that we didn't actually include, even though we read it for this week's reviews.
Totally.
And it came out this week, is Strain number one, and Volume number two, number one, easily.
The Fall, Yeah, Superior Carnage are the ones where we viewed is probably my favorite. But after that, you know, there's such all. I would actually put all four other books, you know, including the Star Wars book, as awful.
Yeah, not a great week. But hey, you win some, you lose some. All right, guys, I am Mo_WeTalk, and our missing host is Chris_WeTalk, both on Twitter. Reach us at comics@WeTalkPodcast. As far as I'm concerned, I'm OUT. You two can do what you'd like.
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter. And I don't have any writing coming up this week, so maybe I should get on some.
900 things?
That's just being cruel.
You know what? Yeah, it's going to be 900 weeks before we get the next one.
crap. I had to count giving up the blog as one of my 900 things.
Nice.
All right. Well, I am Brett _ WeTalk. That's with two T's. I just had two numbers games column, the Independence and the Marvel numbers games, come out on Comicosity just recently. Coming up soon, I'm going to have my latest Access All Ages. So I, on the other side of the coin, have been a busy writer. Check them all out. Check out our friends everywhere. And, I think for this episode, we are totally OET.
Yes, we are. But Brett, next week, retro comic book gaming. Now we're
T-O-U-O.
T-O-U-O. And Keith, we're saving you from...
Here I come to save the day.
Saving you from bad podcasts.
Yeah. Too late.